Welcome to episode 72 of Paper Talk, a series of podcast interviews featuring artists and professionals who are working in the field of hand papermaking and paper art. I'm Helen Hebert, and I run Helen Hebert Studio, a hand papermaking studio in Colorado's Rocky Mountains, where I create artist books and installations. I also host the annual Red Cliff Paper Retreat and papermaking masterclasses right here in the studio. And I teach online classes about paper, light, and books, too. Find out more at HelenHebertStudio.com. Today, I'm talking with Erica Spitzer Rasmussen, an artist who creates handmade paper garments, neckwear, and small editions of hand-bound books. She received her BFA and MFA at the University of Minnesota, Minneapolis, which included coursework in Mexico and Greece. Her current work explores issues of identity and corporeality and has been featured in magazines such as Fiber Arts, Surface Design Journal, American Craft, and Hand Papermaking. Rasmussen teaches studio arts as a full professor at Metropolitan State University in St. Paul, Minnesota. Enjoy our conversation. Well, Erica Spitzer Rasmussen, welcome to Paper Talk. It's great to have you on. Yeah.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And you are a lifetime Minnesotan, is that right?
More or less.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. So tell me a little about your childhood and any artistic influences you had.
Sure. I grew up in Minneapolis. My father was a professor of sociology, and my mother was an artist, an art educator. She later married a potter who was also a professor at the University of Minnesota. So I grew up with many academics and artists in my life. I probably like many other girls of my generation, I grew up at my mother's knee, learning how to sew. Mm-hmm. I was never very interested in dolls, however. I was always making clothes for my stuffed animals or making puppets and things. When I got to college, and I went to the Minneapolis College of Art and Design and the University of Minnesota, I really had two major influences in my life, both women artists. One was my mother, who I mentioned, yes.
And what did your mother, what was her medium?
She was a fiber artist.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah. And my painting professor, Diane Katsifikas. So I was initially studying drawing and painting, and I thought that that was going to be my thing. It just seemed the most immediate, and I was always interested in the body. That's always been my subject matter. But eventually, I found that I became rather frustrated working two-dimensionally. And maybe we can talk a little bit more about that. I mean, you know, where papermaking entered my life.
Yes.
Yeah. So, you know, I took papermaking once as an undergraduate. It was an elective course. And I studied with the printmaker, papermaker, Jerry Krebs at the university there. And, you know, I really enjoyed the process. I liked the hands-on kind of tactile quality and the meditative, repetitive actions that took place there. But still, drawing, paint, and painting were in my sights.
And what was the format of that course? Was it sheet forming? Was it doing sculpture? You know, how elaborate was it?
Yeah. It was an introductory course, so we did a number of things. It began with sheet making and eventually rolled into sculptural objects.
Okay.
later, I found myself, after I was married and had spent some time abroad living elsewhere. And that's the thing I would state about my life is that although I am a Minnesotan, I have lived abroad and I have worked abroad, I've taught abroad. So Minnesota is my home base. It continues to be that. But I would also say that part of my work, part of my artistic practice is getting out of Minnesota from time to time. And luckily we have a hub airport, so I do that.
Sure. So anyway, tell me a little bit about what you did abroad and what you did right after college.
My painting professor, Diane Katsiafikas, who was a Greek American, helped me to find a job in Thessaloniki, which is northern Greece. And I'm a city girl, and I've worked in museums, in galleries most of my life, but she arranged for me to take a position as a farmhand. Uh-huh. So I found myself working in the fields and slaughtering chickens and various other things like that. But it allowed me to travel, to study many of the things that I was looking at as an undergraduate. I had a minor in art history. So I was able to spend time in Athens and in Turkey and, you know, various places around that part of the world, which really was quite eye-opening for me.
Now, did she recommend that you go do that, or did you want to and ask her? Like, how did that happen?
No, she thought it up.
Okay.
She thought it would help expand my world. I also studied in Mexico when I was an undergraduate too.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So, you know, she was just helping me expand my horizons a little bit. I've also spent some time working in Italy, I go there with regularity now. I have taught for the University of Georgia in mm-hmm. Cortona, and I go every other year now to Italy and do a residency at the Graphic Arts Institute there. Oh. And, you know, so there's various things going on. It's important to get out of Minnesota from time to time.
Oh, yeah. It's important to get out of anywhere, I think. Yeah, it's great.
Agreed.
Good. Yeah. So I think you discovered, or you came back to paper in graduate school?
Yes, yes. I'll tell you about that. This part requires a little bit of storytelling and a little bit of audio biographical information that will probably cause me to blush.
Okay.
I was recently married and enrolled at graduate school at the University of Minnesota in the winter of 1996. And as you know, in Minnesota, probably like Colorado, the winters can be harsh. Mm-hmm. And I decided that I was going to grow out my leg and armpit hair for the first time since I was 12 years old. I did this for a couple of different reasons. One, I found the task of shaving just to be time consuming. Mm-hmm. I added it up once. If you do it every other day for 4 minutes a day, it equates to about 18 hours per year. Wow. And that is time, right? Yeah. That could be used more constructively. I was also pleasantly surprised to learn that my husband didn't have a problem with the fact that I might let the hair, you know, grow.
Yeah. Yeah.
And also, it was winter, as I said, and a little extra insulation to the cold couldn't hurt.
Right.
So I was teaching drawing for the University of Minnesota as a TA, mm-hmm. and I took my students that winter to the dairy barn to draw the resident animals. We were in the maternity ward when a cow started to give birth.
Wow.
This was really exciting, especially for me. Like I said, I'm a city girl. I had never experienced a cow birth before. And my students and I, we all hunkered down with the cow. We wanted to give her moral support. We chanted very quietly, "Go, cow, go. Go, cow, go." And eventually, it was a difficult birth. So the veterinarian had to step in and provide assistance. He put his arm in the cow. He pulled out the calf. The calf arrives. Everybody applauds. It was wonderful. And then the cow stands up. It's like origami, right? This great big animal stands up and unfolds. And then what happened was the cow ate the placenta. My students got totally grossed out. They were making all kinds of noises like, ooh, and gross. And I thought to myself, there's nothing disgusting about that. That is a perfectly natural occurrence. Mm-hmm. Oddly enough, the same night I was in the bathtub, I looked down at my hairy legs and I felt the sensation that was like my stomach was turning, and I almost felt as if I might vomit. And then I thought to myself, this is so crazy. How can I watch a cow eat a placenta and have no adverse reaction, but then view my own harmless leg hair and feel sick to my stomach? Epiphany. That's when I decided I need to look into this a little further. What is the significance of hair on the female body? Where did I develop this reaction that is so severe? And so it later occurred to me, not just then and there in the bathtub, but in the days that followed, that I had an experience from my childhood that no doubt left a big impression on my mind. And so this memory came back to me. When I was a little girl, my father told me that eating tomatoes would make me big and strong and hairy-chested. So, you know, when I was a girl, I didn't know truth from fiction.
Right.
I stopped eating tomatoes right then and there.
Right.
Funny thing is, my brother, he went on to eat his tomatoes, and you should see how hairy he turned out.
At
any rate, what I decided at that point was that I needed to make some three-dimensional works about this experience. And from this project, or from this memory, I should say, from this experience, it pushed me back into the paper shop. I thought, this is a place where I can make sculptural forms that emulate the body. Mm-hmm. And I made a pair of hose, which I called Placenta Incident.
Mm-hmm.
That was the beginning. As a graduate student, I decided that I needed to work in handmade paper because paper speaks about fragility. It's the thing that's most akin to the skin, right? Mm-hmm. It's delicate. It can be ripped. It can be damaged. It can be marred. And so I fashioned these hose. What I did actually was I cast some mannequin legs out of paper, and then I slit them up the back and sewed them back together. Mm-hmm. I made a concoction of paper that was actually more like felt. It was so hairy. It was made of camel's hair and jute. And then I layered that on the outside of the rigid legs. And then I took some upholstery tacks, which I gold leafed, and I pushed them from the inside out. And what that did was it made a pattern of them. It made for this bristly quality that was for me a reference to that tactile quality, you know, of the hair when it starts growing out and it's so uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And I started exploring the history of Western art and how women's bodies were portrayed. And I found some very interesting things there. You know, like hair is always, is generally, well, not surprisingly, it's more often appointed to male bodily beauty, right? And it's a symbol of power. For hundreds of years in Western art, the female body is represented without body hair, pubic hair included. Right. So the hose for me were really an exploration of that whole idea of where or of the fuzzy lines between masculinity and femininity. I had hoped that maybe I could warm up to the prospect of donning or, you know, or just the body hair, the extra body hair, but I couldn't. In the spring, it all had to come off. It felt, it made me feel heavy and masculine. And so it all, you know, it all went away. It continues to stay away. For me, I'm most comfortable with shaved leg and armpits. You know, and that's, you know, and I recognize too that there is public memory and there's cultural conditioning. As a daughter of a sociologist, I recognize that the imagery from fashion magazines to the history of art influence not only myself, but, you know, women of our generation about what the codes are, what the norms are for beautiful bodies. And right. So I've been struggling with that for some time.
Yeah, that's really interesting. By the way, we'll post a picture of the placenta incident on the webpage for the podcast so viewers can, or listeners can see that, can view that. And yeah, I lived in Germany when I was in college, and it's not as common for women to shave their legs there or their armpits. So I came back, this was in my 20s, and I sort of stopped for a while, but I felt like I had really blonde hair before I started shaving, but it started coming in blacker. And I didn't like that. And I also swim for exercise. So, you know, women at the pool are all shaved. And so, yeah, I think I have a little bit of peer pressure there. And yeah, so I went back to shaving.
You can swim a little faster without excess body hair too, I understand.
That's right. We had, I swam in college on the swim team and there were all kinds of things we did. Yeah, shaving was one for sure, but to try to make us faster. Yeah. Wow. Well, that is fascinating. So let's keep going. So you teach, you've been teaching, did you get a master's with a papermaking focus?
I got a Master of Fine Arts in Studio Arts with an emphasis, oddly enough, still in drawing and painting.
Okay.
When I entered the graduate program, I thought that that was still my medium. But, you know, I just, the subject matter was always the same. It was about the body. Mm-hmm. And by the time I mounted my thesis exhibition, there was not a drawing or painting in sight. It was all paper garments. Mm-hmm. And so that was fine. We didn't have to really clarify or stipulate what our medium was. There was room for growth there. Mm-hmm. And so I've been making paper garments and also books now since I left graduate school. It just seems to be my path forward.
Right. And I know you're a professor and you teach, and did you go into that right after graduate school as well?
I did. Mm-hmm. I began at Metropolitan State University in St. Paul the day after I left graduate school. So I've been there for over 20 years now.
Okay. Wow. And what about facilities? So obviously you made paper in graduate school at the university facility. And then what happened after that? And I'm guessing you've set one up at Metropolitan State, and then—
Well, I'll tell you. When I left graduate school, I was without papermaking facilities. And so Amanda Degener from Cave Paper suggested that I look into Minnesota Center for Book Arts. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, close by. So I applied and I became the paper artist in residence. Okay. That allowed me to use the paper shop for the year that I was there. And that's been great. And to this day, I continue to be a member and also an artist, a member of the artist cooperative there. And it's an important piece of our paper and book culture, obviously, in the Twin Cities. So we don't have a paper shop at Metropolitan State. Okay. So what I do is I take my students to MCBA. We rent the facilities there by the semester.
Oh, okay.
And then in terms of my own practice, mm-hmm. I have a paper shop, which my husband and I constructed in the backyard here in Minnesota. And it's a three-season paper shop. So that works fine for me because, frankly, during the academic year, I'm generally too busy mm-hmm. to get my hands dirty every day. School always seems to take precedence when school is in session. But that means that I have a good majority of the spring, the whole of summer, and part of the fall to make paper. And so I do that. And then I have an indoor space in the lower level of my house where we are now, which is what I call my dry space or my dry shop, where I'm building things part-time throughout the year.
Yeah, I want to hear a little bit more about your outdoor studio, because I think, you know, it's there are all kinds of studios, and I haven't talked to that many that have an outdoor one. So mm-hmm. people might be interested in that.
Sure. Well, my shop began with an Oracle beater. Mm-hmm. I received that as part of an artist initiative grant through the state of Minnesota in 2017. And what I did was I beat invasive species from Minnesota parks into pulp and then taught children in the area at art centers and libraries how to make paper and bind books. Mm-hmm. Then I said to my husband, well, if the state of Minnesota has bought me this beater, it's our responsibility to house it, because, you know, it had been in the garage, you know, right, that first year. And so what we did was we had a prefab building made and moved to our backyard.
Okay.
And we poured the foundation with a some drainage. And my husband dug the drain field. So I'm not hooked up to the water of the house. It's a little complicated because mm-hmm. we have hard freezes in Minnesota winters.
Right.
But in the summer or anytime, you know, it's not freezing, yeah, I hook the hose up to the paper shop. Uh-huh. And I can function out there just fine. I have a small water heater. So when I know I need some warmth to the water, I can turn that on. Mm-hmm. I have electricity. Everything is functioning like a regular shop. And then the water exits through the floor and runs down to the garden and waters the vegetables and the fruit that we grow out there.
Oh, and how many square feet is this about?
It's about 150 square feet, okay, so it's not a large one.
Right.
160 maybe?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so you have your beater in there now?
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm. Yes.
So mostly, we're going to talk more about your work, but What size sheets do you make?
I make terribly large sheets. Sometimes they're 14 by 18 mm-hmm. or smaller. Mm-hmm. And I really, and then I piece them together.
Right.
That's what I do, you know, after they're dried, overlapping that adhesive to make for running yardage.
Right. Yeah. Okay. I want to come back to that. I just am curious also about teaching at MCBA. So do you have students coming there for like every class for a certain amount of time? Or are you meeting at the college sometimes too? Just a little bit about how that collaboration works.
Right. Sure. At MCBA. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm getting a little signal. Yeah. It's breaking up just a little bit.
Okay.
So my paper shop is just for me. It's really a one person shop.
Right.
Because it's relatively small. And then at Minnesota Center for Book Arts, we go there on a weekly basis. And students can have access as they need it. There are open studios and so forth so that mm-hmm. they can get their work done.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's cool. Okay, so I want to hear more about your work then, and maybe, I don't know what piece to talk about next. you choose one. You sent me a bunch of images and
I sent you a short list because you had asked about, you know, various works that that stem from my autobiographical experiences, right? Well, one of them is called Juju Dress. Mm-hmm. I made that one in my mid-30s. I had my career well established, and you know, I had spent so much time making artwork and showing artwork and working up the ladder at school to solidify my position. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly, to my surprise, I wanted to have a family.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, in my mid-30s, I found that my body was having some problems getting with the program. Mm. So that was when I started making work to maybe encourage fertility. I wanted to enlist magical forces.
Yeah.
I'm very interested in ritualistic wear, you know, like how people over the ages have made garments and ritualistic objects to help encourage magical forces, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I remembered then, another memory came back to me, that when I was a little girl, that the myth was, if you swallowed a watermelon seed, that's how you became pregnant. Now, really, this is brilliant, right?
Yeah.
A seed is a universal symbol of fertility, but right. also the shape, right?
Yeah.
Of a watermelon is like a woman's pregnant belly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, I must admit, I tried swallowing a watermelon seed that summer, no avail. And eventually I had to go and get a little medical assistance. Mm-hmm. But I made myself this dress, what I call a juju dress.
Mm-hmm.
And juju, of course, you know, is an African term that means magical.
Yeah.
African, maybe Ghanaian. At any rate, what I did was I made this dress that I could wear to my monthly procedures, and it looked like armor, like Italian armor, because I felt as if I was battling infertility. And at every juncture, I tied a watermelon seed.
Oh.
So this dress had this wonderful rattle to it. When I wore it, like the nurses could hear me coming down the hall. They just loved that. They knew when I was on my way.
Right.
And I don't know exactly what worked, but today, as you know, I have a 16-year-old boy. So something worked and the juju dress was retired.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about making that. It's a series of diamond-shaped pieces and watermelon beads.
Right. Well, I made two layers of this dress. It started actually with one of my very comfortable sleeveless summer dresses. Mm-hmm. I cut it apart and I used it for the pattern. Mm-hmm. Then I got a sheet of Julie McLaughlin's big ass paper.
Oh,
and I made a sheath that goes underneath.
Okay.
Very delicate and light. And then on top of that, I created this armor-like structure. I cast these diamond-shaped plates from cookie tins, cookie molds, and then I drilled holes into them, gold leafed them, and I made a pattern, a dress-shaped pattern that went on top of that. And I used wax linen thread to tie the plates together. And that's where I adhered a watermelon seed at every point that I tied. Now, keep in mind, this was when watermelon seeds were in the process of going out because they were, remember, they were engineering them so that we had these seedless watermelons.
Yeah.
Well, they got very small that summer. They were so tiny. And my husband and I ate a lot of watermelon and we saved all the seeds except for the one I ate. And then I drilled into each one of them, which was really difficult because they were so small. I could barely hold on to the seed and drill it at the same time. So the point is, I guess, is that all of my work starts with handmade paper. It's so flexible and malleable and seems to assume any characteristic that I need it to have. And then I embellish and I use materials that help me to tell my stories. And it doesn't matter to me if the materials that I use are non-archival. I have the work photographed immediately. And then we'll see. The point is that I'm able to share my experiences with other people.
Hey, listeners, let's take a little break here. And I want to tell you about the Paper Advisor, a place where you can discover my most popular papermaking and papercraft resources, including information about tools and supplies, how-to videos, and paper tips, all in one place. You can ask the Paper Advisor your paper questions there, too. And best of all, it's free. Find the Paper Advisor by going to HelenHebertStudio.com and looking for the Free Paper Advisor link in the upper right-hand corner. Now back to the episode. I love the stories behind your work. And your work is very labor-intensive. Obviously, we'll post a picture of Juju Dress, too. Did you have multiple cookie tins that you were able to cast into?
I have a cookie tin that has 12 molds in it.
Okay, so 12.
So I had to, yes. I had to use it several times over.
Right. And then the fact that you drilled into the dry molded pieces, that's really cool, too. I haven't, you know, come across that before, of drilling into paper. I remember I worked at Oblation Papers and Press in the Pearl District. I was just thinking about this yesterday. They make wedding invitations and things in Portland, Oregon, and they make Japanese stab bound books, and they would drill the holes instead of see people making one or two of those, and they're just punching them with a screw punch or something or an awl. But they made a jig and figured out how to speed up the process. So it's always so interesting to me, different ways people work with materials. But drilling your cast pieces and then the watermelon seeds. And yeah, when I was a kid, I remember huge watermelon seeds. We would split them.
Yes.
But you're right. Yeah. They're like tiny now.
We'd have spitting contests back then. And you can't do that anymore.
Right. Okay. So let's talk about another piece. This is fascinating. How about patch and repair?
Ah, okay, sure. Patch and repair is a party dress that I made to commemorate my 40th birthday.
Okay.
And I did this because my mother used to say, after 40, it's all patch and repair. Mm. So I made this beautiful dress, which is modeled after a 1950s kind of festive attire. Mm-hmm. It has box pleats and polka dots. And it's made out of handmade paper, silk super thread, and spot bandages. So it's just kind of, you know, a playful reminder about how my body is eventually, you know, you're going to start falling apart. And you know, I admit it's inevitable, right? The body is a physical, organic thing, and it will change like my artwork over time. But, you know, darn it, if I know this is going to happen, but I'm going to look my best no matter what.
Yeah, that's great. And I watched a video on your website and saw you have boxes filled with unusual things. Have you always been a collector?
And yeah.
Talk a little bit about the process of collecting. Like, do you, like the watermelon seeds, it sounded like you collected at the time. You had the idea and you did it, but it's, you have other things.
Right.
Do you collect them because you know you'll use them, or just because you like them, and then some, or is it kind of a little bit of both?
I'd say it's a little bit of both. Uh-huh. You know, I love going to thrift stores, mm-hmm. and antique markets and swap meets and looking for notions and oddities and, you know, old patterns, you know, vintage dress patterns and things like that. But sometimes when I have a project in mind, I will go online and look for particular items. Or sometimes I'll let people know what I'm in need of. Mm-hmm. Once I decided that I was going to make a piece, a pair of shoes, and I needed some sharps, like some old blades, mm-hmm. Razor blades and X-Acto blades and, you know, or needles maybe. I didn't know. So I put out a call to a number of friends via email, and an artist in Minneapolis put it on Facebook. And the next day, it was magic. I got a call or an email from a shop that made custom furniture or something weird in New Mexico. And they said, Erica, we have 40 pounds of sharps, old razor blades and things. We will gladly send you via UPS. Just give us your email or your home address. And like 3 days later, I have 40 pounds of sharps sitting on my front step. And, you know, it was wonderfully ridiculous. In the end, I found that I couldn't actually work with them because every time I cut myself with one of them, I would have a panic attack.
Yeah.
Thinking I was going to get infected and sick.
Right.
But, you know, some sharps did end up in that work, just not 40 pounds of them.
Right. Oh, goodness. Okay, let's talk about another piece. And also, why don't you pull in where you show your work? You mentioned the Minnesota Center for Book Arts, but I know you have a gallery where you show your work too.
Is that right?
Right. I also regularly show with the Grand Hand, which is a craft gallery in St. Paul. And then I have other shows here and there. You know, for instance, I'm in the Fiber Art Langsau to Beijing exhibit in China and various other shows that I participate in. I don't have anything really big on the horizon right now. You know, like you're probably finding that the pandemic has really slowed things down.
Yes.
And so I find right now is more of a time for making.
Mm-hmm.
But right. There's always works in the pipeline.
Yeah. And are you on sabbatical this year also? Did you tell me? So you're not teaching?
Yes.
And has that been so you
correct?
Must have been...
I'm on sabbatical this year.
Okay.
And I had many projects scheduled abroad, and none of them, of course, could come to fruition.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm happy to be home right now and not teaching online. I find technology challenging.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm grateful to be home with my son, mm-hmm. who is learning remotely right now and providing some support. Mm-hmm. And then I'm in the studio every day.
Yeah. And so behind you, of course, listeners can't see this, but is this beautiful piece you've been working on that I want to hear about, Red Tape Cape. I think something hidden
right.
inside.
This piece is called Red Tape Cape. And I just finished it.
Ooh.
It took me a year to complete.
Wow.
So I decided... because I work at a university, and every year the amount of paperwork increases, that what I really needed was a red tape cape to help me fight bureaucracy.
All right.
So I made this full-length coat that is sheathed in thousands and thousands of pieces of red tape, which have been folded over onto themselves and sewn onto the cape. The interior of the cape is lined with paperwork, primarily from my university. And then into the hem, I installed a secret note to myself on handmade paper. And my intent is to wear this when school gets back in session to an occasional faculty meeting, when I know that things are going to be particularly difficult or complex in some way. So that's, you know, if you want to know what's going on in my life, you need only look to my work, because it's, you know, my work is really an extension of myself, or sometimes what's going on with my body. It's all about, you know, using the body or garments as a metaphor for addressing some tough topics. And I like to do that with a little bit of humor. It's important to interject a little humor or sometimes beauty, I find, so that there's an entrance point for conversation.
Yeah.
I don't want to shut people down,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
With my issues or my concerns. I'd rather that we, you know, find a healthy way around it.
Yeah, I love that. And do any of your colleagues know about this piece, or will it be like a shock when you wear it?
My closest of colleagues know about it, yes.
Okay.
Do, but it has not yet had the occasion to make an appearance.
Wonderful. Okay, I want to hear about the coat of invocation also. That one was really interesting.
Right. You had asked me about my use of embedding or secret mm-hmm. things mm-hmm. into my work. Sometimes I embed actual objects like toenails or hair and you know, odd things like that. But at other times, I'll use notes to myself. I have a typewriter. I love typing away on this old-fashioned machine. on handmade paper, and then installing these notes either in hems or pockets and things. Mm-hmm. Code for Invocation was a piece that I made when my mother was sick for the second time with cancer. And it is based actually on a Japanese happy coat. It's a very boxy kind of kimono. Mm-hmm. And I covered it with all of these commercial 2-inch by 2-inch envelopes. And I dyed them and stained them. And I put a wish inside each one, like a Shinto shrine, you know, where you can utilize text. Yeah, to make your plea to the gods, I installed a note in every one of these little envelopes and then sewed them onto the coat, asking the higher powers for recuperation on my mother's behalf. Mm-hmm. I'm afraid it didn't work. It did not work. I lost my mother to cancer. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, I find that my work is a coping device.
Right.
Yeah, that's what it is for me. It's a place for me to invest my thoughts, my wishes, my hopes, and it's a meditative quality, as you know. It's a meditative thing to pull a sheet of paper one after another, or to sew an object one after another. There's repetition, and there's time to think and to process. Yeah. So, and I don't know, maybe making art is even cheaper than therapy. I don't know. It's what I do. It's what I do.
Yeah. Oh, I can see how it's very healing and meditative. And yeah. And do you hand stitch? Do you use a sewing machine? Do you do both?
It's a combination.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
When there's a lot of territory to cover and you'll never see the stitches like in Red Tape Cape behind me, then I'll use the sewing machine. But I prefer to sew by hand.
Yeah. Well, cool. And we haven't talked about your artist books. Tell me about one of those or in general.
Oh, sure. Yeah. When I got to Minnesota Center for Book Arts, I started taking classes in book arts. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as a paper maker, you're going to make a lot of sheets. So you got to do, you know, there's room for books, right? In my life, I make a lot of sheets. I fell in love with bookmaking. I make both traditional books, like the one you can see behind me is my first book of letterpress, which I finished this fall, which features the poetry of Leo Graham, an upstate New York poet. But I also make other books which are a little more sculptural and unconventional, maybe in their format. I like to make round books in particular. And I'm just putting the finishing touches on this book, which I'm going to call my Book of Shame. So Book of Shame is a round book. It looks like a collar. It is actually wearable. Mm-hmm. And what I did was I typed up 27 secrets on my typewriter. It was an exercise in self-reflection. Mm-hmm. I then copied those secrets onto my handmade paper, which is a combination of cotton and abaca, and cut them into teeny tiny squares and installed them into the pages of the book. You can see that there are like these little portals that I'm making, these round portals. Mm-hmm. That way I can retain my privacy. You can get bits and pieces of my shameful acts, but you won't get the whole of the story. So that's a work that is in process right now that, you know, is fairly typical of my bookmaking practice. And yeah, I like to make non-conventional books, sculptural books.
Yeah, and how about the wearable aspect? Like some of your pieces are wearable. Are they all wearable?
No, not all of them. The round books are generally wearable. Here, I'm going to demonstrate. I know the viewers at home can't see this, but I can always send you a photograph.
Yeah.
That it looks like a Flemish ruff or a collar, 16th century collar.
How does it make you feel wearing all of your shame around your neck?
It feels heavy. It feels heavy. Dark. Yeah. It's playful at the same time. I kind of think of collars as restraints, like a dog wearing its collar. It only has so much liberty. And my collars often refer to weights around my neck or restraints in life.
I just wanted to ask you a little more about the paper making process. So you make sheets for books, and then you also make sheets for your sculptures. And I'm just wondering about the drying process and the pressing.
Do you do different? Yeah, I'm pretty low tech. Other than my Oracle beater, I am pretty much old school. So I use a sponge. And then I hang my paper on Pellon on a line, a clothes line, and let it dry naturally. I do have a nipping press, so the sheets can go in the nipping press later if I need them to be flatter.
Right.
And then another thing that I do is I work sculpturally a lot too. So I will mix an adhesive like Elmer's glue into lightly beaten cotton and work with it sculpturally, maybe around a mannequin or a cast from my own body. And then I can obviously, you know, peel it off later as long as I remember to put in a barrier. So my paper, happens in a couple of different ways. My working methods vary.
And are you casting sheets or pulp onto your mannequins? Like, do you make sheets first and wrap them, or is it pulp with the glue in it?
Pulp with the glue in it.
Yeah,
it is casting. When I need to make a traditional garment form, I will let the sheets dry and then adhere them together and make many, many yards of running paper, you know, like fabric on a bolt. Or the other technique is to work in that casting method with the glue.
Okay.
And
What's the longest bolt you've made? Paper bolt. I like that.
Oh gosh. Maybe 12 to 16 feet long. And generally 36 inches wide.
And so then you're cutting your pieces out of it.
Right. And then I can sew them together. Exactly.
Right.
Similar to clothing.
Ah, cool. Right. And you had some recommendations. Let's talk about those. So one was your Oracle beater, and you got that from Lee Scott McDonald. Is that right?
I did.
Yeah.
I did indeed. Yeah. I love it. It's a trooper. I couldn't live without it.
Yeah. Great.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. And what else did you have to recommend?
Oh, I just got a new guillotine. You know, it's wonderful at Minnesota Center for Book Arts. I can use the guillotines there. I love those old school cast iron tools, which are stationary, unfortunately, right? I use them to trim the four edges of my books and various other things. But it's not always convenient for me to drive to Minneapolis. I live in a suburb of St. Paul. So I got a new guillotine paper cutter, which can cut up to 400 sheets of commercial paper at a time, you know, lightweight, like office, 20-pound paper.
Yeah.
But this just opens up a new world of possibilities for my bookmaking in-house. And I love that tool.
Is that something that you bought that other people can purchase, or did you find
Absolutely.
It used?
Oh. I got mine on Amazon.
Okay.
Yeah, and they come in different models. I bought the larger one, which is 18 inches wide, which is plenty big enough for my bookmaking purposes.
Yeah, well, maybe we'll put a link to what you have.
Sure.
Just for
sure.
People who might be interested. And then tell me about flocking. You started flocking.
You know, flock is a kind of a old school surfacing technique,
mm-hmm.
where small bits of fibers are adhered to surfaces. Like in old jewelry boxes, you might see flocking
yeah.
lining the interior, and it comes in many different colors. Or remember in the old fashioned wallpaper
mm-hmm.
that sometimes was fuzzy?
Yeah.
That flocking too.
Uh-huh.
So I just started working with flocking in my own work. For instance, I just finished a new pair of shoes called Crisis of Conscience. And I flocked the interior of the shoes. So I flock them black, and it makes for a nice flat but fuzzy surface. And I like the dichotomy of surfaces in my work. Mm-hmm. So the exterior will often be different than the interior.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it just works out perfectly for me. And is also a relatively quick and easy technique to pull off, in that if you're flocking paper, you first need to put something non-porous on it, like a shellac or a latex paint. Mm-hmm. But after that dries, you adhere a layer of adhesive of the same color. You wait a few minutes, and then you have this device which pushes it's a tube essentially uh-huh. with holes in the end. You put the flocking material on the inside, and then you push it back and forth, and the flocking material, which is nylon, usually today, little bits of it, like think little bits of velvety, fuzzy stuff.
Uh-huh.
And then it adheres to the adhesive and dries overnight. And it, voila, poof, it's done.
And is the shellac like a resist so that
yes.
it doesn't adhere there? Or
yeah. Yes. It makes for the non-porous surface in between the paper and the adhesive.
Okay.
So that the flock can stick to something. Yeah.
Right.
So flocking is fun.
Yeah.
I'm enjoying the flocking process, and I intend to do much more of it.
Okay. Well, you said you've just finished this red tape cape. Do you have another piece on the horizon?
Well, I'm working on a new corset.
Okay.
Which is embellished with human hair, and it'll be surfaced with antique buttons.
Mm.
No doubt the interior will be painted with tomato paste or maybe sheathed in dehydrated cherry tomatoes.
Okay.
So I think the hair and tomatoes have probably become my signature materials.
Yeah.
A new work about my battles with body hair and my issue with tomatoes. Yeah.
That's fantastic. Well, thank you so much for sharing your story with me and the listeners. And tell us where we can find you online.
Ah, yes. You'll find my work on my webpage at www.erasbitzerrasmussen.com, or you can find me on Instagram at erica_spitzer_rasmussen.
Great. Well, I'll post those links in the show notes, and best of luck to you getting through COVID, and we hope we're close to a new horizon here. I look forward to seeing you in person at a conference soon.
Oh, I look forward to that. Thank you for having me on, Helen.
Yeah.
It's been a delight.
Thank you, Erica. Hey, paper friends. Did you know that I write a weekly blog called The Sunday Paper, featuring stories of people doing exciting, innovative, and beautiful things with paper? Sign up at helenhebertstudio.com/blog.
I'm also creating a lot of content over here, and the best way to stay up to date is to join my newsletter list to learn about free tutorials, online classes, workshops, and the annual Redcliffe Paper Retreat, which takes place right here at Helen Hebert's studio. You can sign up at helenhebertstudio.com to receive my e-newsletter. This wraps up our episode, and if you enjoyed it, I'd appreciate it if you could leave a review over on iTunes. This helps other people find out about the podcast. Special thanks to Gary A. Hansen for the sound editing and Peter Thomas for the music. Visit helenhebertstudio.com and click on Paper Talk, where you can find out more about them, subscribe to the series via iTunes, and listen to other episodes and access all of the archived shows. I'll talk to you soon.
There's a reason besides the season.